and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, we have a report on this week's mass shooting at Michigan State University. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's technology report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, as a gunman opened fire inside school buildings at Michigan State University on Monday night, students received an alert on their phones. It read, "Run, hide, fight." The students broke windows to escape. They blocked doors and hid under blankets for safety. Others turned their phones to silence, afraid to make any noise. The gunman, a 43-year-old man, killed 3 students and seriously wounded 5 others. The incident ended 3 hours later when the gunman killed himself. Jacqueline Matthews is an international law student at Michigan State. More than 10 years ago, she was a 6th grade student in Newtown, Connecticut, when a gunman entered Sandy Hook Elementary School and killed 26 people. Matthews injured her back while hiding in a corner during the incident. The 21-year-old student said she was shocked to find herself in another mass shooting situation. "The fact that this is the second mass shooting that I have now lived through is incomprehensible," Matthews said in a TikTok video. "We can no longer allow this to happen. We can no longer be complacent." To be complacent means to be satisfied with how things are and not wanting to change them. Matthews was not the only MSU student who had already lived through a school shooting. Jennifer Mancini's daughter is a first-year student at Michigan State. She told the Detroit Free Press newspaper that her daughter also had survived the November 2021 shooting that left 4 students dead at Oxford High School in southeastern Michigan. "I can't believe this is happening again," said Mancini, who did not want her daughter's name used. For students like Matthews and Mancini's daughter, the plan of run, hide, fight in an active shooter situation is becoming familiar. As active shooter incidents increased, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, produced a training video called Run, Hide, Fight. It shows 3 actions that people can do to keep themselves and others safe in an active shooter situation. When a shooter is nearby, the video says, people should run or hide. They should fight only as a last resort. When fighting the attacker, it advises working with others and using available objects as weapons. Many colleges and schools now follow the practice under different names, but the message is the same. Get out of harm's way, hide or barricade, and if an attacker finds you, take action. Supporters say it gives individuals a list of actions that go beyond the traditional lockdown method. But critics say it is misguided to teach students, especially younger ones, to fight back. Some school safety experts say it needlessly puts students in danger. Opponents are pushing for stronger lockdown policies and better training for school safety officials. Joseph Arardi was head of the school system in Newtown, Connecticut, which included Sandy Hook Elementary School. In 2019, after a series of school shootings, Arardi said, "What we've learned over time is to provide staff and students with as many options as possible in the moment." In the last few years, several schools in the U.S. have added panic buttons and live stream cameras so that police officers can see inside classrooms in real time if a gunman enters a school. And across the nation, 911 emergency call centers have added a texting option so that people in an active shooter situation can quietly provide information to police.
Last week, the United States said a balloon shot down by the U.S. military was part of a major international spying operation led by China. The balloon was shot down February 4th over the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of South Carolina. By that time, the balloon had moved across the United States. During its trip, the balloon was observed flying over several Air Force bases, including one in Montana that stores U.S. nuclear weapons. U.S. officials have repeatedly stated they believe China purposefully flew the balloon into U.S. airspace and that the airship had the ability to carry out spying activities. China has said the balloon was an unmanned weather airship that got blown off its path by wind and ended up going into American airspace. Chinese officials have accused the U.S. of overreacting by shooting the balloon down with a missile fired from an F-22 fighter plane. Since the downing of that balloon, U.S. military jets have also shot down three other unidentified objects found moving across American and Canadian territory. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said last week that while those three objects were not confirmed to be spy balloons, the U.S. couldn't rule out that possibility. Kirby added that the U.S. decided to take out the three other high-flying objects out of an abundance of caution because they might have presented a risk to civilian planes in the area. U.S. officials have suggested that such balloons have limited additive capabilities compared to China's other intelligence-gathering programs. So how effective are air balloons at carrying out spying activities? Experts say such efforts might seem low-tech compared to satellites and other intelligence-gathering methods. But they can be useful instruments if they are equipped with the right technology tools. Historically, high-flying balloons have often been used for spying and military activities. During World War II, Japan's military dropped bombs into U.S. territory using balloons designed to float in jet stream air currents. No military targets were damaged by the balloons, but several civilians were killed when one of the balloons crashed in a forest in the northwestern state of Oregon. Just after World War II, the U.S. military started exploring the use of deployed spy balloons. This led to a series of operations called Project Genetrix. U.S. government documents suggest the project flew photographic balloons over Soviet Union-supported territory in the 1950s. Spy balloons generally operate at 24,000 to 37,000 meters, well above where civilian air traffic flies. Passenger airlines rarely fly higher than 12,000 meters. A 2009 report to the U.S. Air Force's Air Command and Staff College said one advantage of balloons over satellites is the ability to observe wide areas of territory at closer distances. Balloons are also able to spend a longer time over target areas, the report said. Experts have also noted that balloons do not cost a lot of money to deploy. Satellites, on the other hand, require complex space launch systems that can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. William Kim is an expert in intelligence balloons at the Marathon Initiative Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He told the French news agency AFP that balloons are valuable observation tools that are difficult to shoot down. Kim said the Chinese balloon shot down by the U.S. was likely a normal weather balloon with some added technology. Images of the balloon showed that it was solar-powered and appeared to have electronics, guidance, and data-collecting abilities, he added. Kim said he believes the balloon was powered by artificial intelligence, AI technology. This would enable it to guide itself based on air changes in the atmosphere. Before, you either had to have a tether, or you just send it up and it just goes wherever the wind takes it, Kim said. Another possible advantage of balloons over satellites is that they are difficult to find with traditional radar equipment. These are materials that don't reflect. They're not metal, Kim said. So even though these balloons expand to quite large, detecting the balloon itself is going to be a problem, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, Brian Lynn joins me to talk more about this week's technology report. Welcome, Brian.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Ashley.
In today's report, you looked at how weather-like balloons might be effective at carrying out spying activities. This followed widespread media attention about the shooting down of what American officials described as a spy balloon discovered over U.S. territory. China launched the balloon. The report centered on how useful this kind of balloon could be compared to satellites and other tools. It sure seems like balloons are low-tech compared to other methods, but what kinds of things can they do?
In the report, I did list some of the ways experts said balloons could be useful in gathering certain kinds of information. For example, one government report noted that balloons flying at extremely high altitudes can observe very wide areas of territory, just like a satellite, but at much closer distances than a satellite would operate from.
Okay, and they are also much easier to get in the air, right?
Yes, correct. That is, in fact, one big advantage of using this kind of balloon for intelligence gathering. The balloons do not require complex space launches to deploy, even though they can operate at very high altitude levels, and they do not cost much money to develop and equip, again, compared to more costly and technology-rich intelligence-gathering methods.
I know you also examined the history of balloons used in this way. When is the first known use of such equipment for spying?
So, one of the first recorded uses was during World War II, when Japan's military experimented with dropping bombs from balloons onto U.S. territory.
Okay, well, thanks again for joining me today on the program, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 1892 was a presidential election year in the United States. In that year, most parts of the American economy were expanding, but one part was not doing well: agriculture. The result was the birth of a new political party. It was called the People's Party. Its members were called populists. Stan Busby and Morris Joyce tell about the populists and how they campaigned against the Republicans and Democrats in the election.
In the late 1880s, a North Carolina farming publication described America's economy this way: "There is something radically wrong in our industrial system. The railroads are making much money, yet agriculture is failing. The banks are doing great business, yet agriculture is failing. Towns and cities grow, yet agriculture is failing. Wages were never so high, yet agriculture is failing." Historians give four major reasons why agriculture was failing in the late 1880s. One was the high cost of transportation. Second was high taxes. Third was falling prices for agricultural products. And fourth was the high cost of borrowing money.
Farmers began to organize to discuss their problems. They formed local groups called alliances. An alliance member described the result of these discussions: "People began to think who had never thought before. People talked who had never spoken much. Little by little, they began to study their condition. They discussed taxes on income, government ownership of property, the unity of labor, and a thousand other opposing ideas."
Local alliances formed larger groups. The larger groups included many persons who were not farmers, but who lived and worked in agricultural areas. These included teachers, doctors, repairmen, reporters, and church leaders. In 1889, the major alliances held separate conventions in St. Louis, Missouri. They refused to form one big alliance. They were divided on several important issues.
The chief issue was political. leaders of the Northern Alliance had decided that agricultural interests could expect little help from either the Republican or Democratic parties. They believed the answer to their problems was a third national political party. Leaders of the Southern Alliance disagreed. They belonged to the Democratic Party. And at that time, Democrats faced little opposition in the South. A new party would weaken their political power. So they wanted to work for change within the existing Democratic Party.
Another issue dividing the Northern and Southern alliances was racial. How would a united alliance deal with black farmers? The Southern Alliance did not permit black members, and it did not want blacks in a united alliance. The Northern Alliance said blacks could join. The two groups could not settle their differences before the state and congressional elections of 1890. So they did not campaign as one party, but they campaigned for one idea: help for America's farmers. Throughout the South and Middle West, they succeeded in electing agricultural candidates as governors, state legislators, senators, and members of the House of Representatives.
Farm leaders everywhere were surprised by their election victories in 1890. They had not expected to win so much so quickly. Leaders of the Northern Alliance decided the time was right to form one party to represent all farmers. They felt sure of success. For now, enough leaders of the Southern Alliance were willing to support the idea. These Southern leaders had succeeded within the Democratic Party, but they quickly learned that they held political power only at the local level. They held almost no power at the national level. So, a few months before the presidential election of 1892, America's agricultural alliances held a joint convention in Omaha, Nebraska. They formed a new party. They called it the People's Party. They called themselves populists.
Delegates to the convention approved a policy statement for the new party. The statement said the national government should own the country's railroads, telegraph, and telephone systems. It said the government, not banks, should supply paper money. And it said no limits should be put on government production of silver money. The populists called for a tax on earnings, fewer working hours for labor, controls on immigration. To help farmers, the populists demanded what they called the sub-treasury plan. Under this plan, farmers could put their crops in government storehouses. Then they could wait to sell the crops until prices rose. While they waited, they could borrow money from the government at low cost. They would pay back the loans when they sold their crops.
The new People's Party also proposed ways to make government more democratic. It said secret ballots should be used in all elections. It said senators should be elected by the people, not chosen by state legislatures. Most Americans considered populist proposals extreme. They felt the proposals were too close to socialism or communism. The populists considered their proposals just. They felt their movement was a struggle for more equal control of the nation. On one side of the struggle were producers. These included farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. They were led by the New People's Party. On the other side were what populists called non-producers. These included wealthy bankers and leaders of industry. They were led by the Republican and Democratic parties. Populists wanted producers to have some of the political power traditionally held by non-producers. They wanted producers to get a fairer share of the nation's increasing wealth.
The People's Party chose James Weaver as its candidate in the presidential election of 1892. Weaver had been an officer in the Union Army during America's Civil War. He had served in the House of Representatives, and he had been the candidate of a minor party in the presidential election of 1880. The Republican Party renominated President Benjamin Harrison, and the Democratic Party nominated former President Grover Cleveland.
The campaign began quietly, but a few months before the election, a labor dispute exploded into an important campaign issue. Several thousand steel workers went on strike at a factory owned by the Carnegie Steel Company in Homestead, Pennsylvania. The steel workers' union called the strike after failing to reach a wage agreement with company officials. After months of growing tension, the head of the company sent 300 private security officers to break up the strike and protect non-union workers. The security officers and many of the strikers carried guns. Shots were fired. 10 men were killed. The governor of Pennsylvania immediately sent state soldiers to the steel factory. After a few more attempts to continue the strike, the union admitted defeat. Its power was crushed. It would be more than 40 years before America's steel workers were organized again.
A short time later, state soldiers were used to break up a strike by railroad workers in New York, and federal soldiers were used against striking silver miners in Idaho. This use of government troops to end strikes caused many citizens to vote against the ruling Republican Party. They voted for the opposition Democratic or People's Parties instead. In the election of 1892, Republican President Benjamin Harrison was defeated. Democrat Grover Cleveland, who had lost to Harrison 4 years earlier, would be president again. The People's Party candidate, James Weaver, won 1 million popular votes and 22 electoral votes.
Grover Cleveland returned to the White House, just as his wife had said he would. But his second administration would be much more difficult than his first. Within 2 months of Cleveland's inauguration, the United States entered into one of the worst economic depressions in its history.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.